My name is Catherine Parnell. Welcome, all of you. I'm the senior associate editor for Consequence magazine, and I see a few familiar faces here. Consequence deals with the culture and consequences of war, which is why I'm here talking to you, moderating this panel about fiction, war, and the home front. Allow me to introduce our three panelists. One of our panelists will be joining us in just a moment. That's He's in the back of the room. To my left is Laura Harrington, who she's written plays, librettos, lyrics for musicals. We should get her to sing. And classical music compositions. Her newest musical, Alice Unwrapped, is based on her debut novel about a family dealing with the Iraq War. Alice Bliss. Laura is the recipient of numerous awards and grants. She currently teaches playwriting at MIT. Her second book is what we'll be talking about today, A Catalog of Birds. In the back of the room, and he'll be joining us in just, I'll wait till he comes up. To my right is Jessica Shattuck. Her debut novel, The Hazards of Good Breeding, is an exploration into the veneers and true lives of New England aristocracy. That's us, right? All of us. And it was followed by Perfect Life. Her short fiction has appeared in Glamour, The New Yorker, and Open City, among other publications, and her nonfiction has been published in Lit Hub, Boston Globe, The New York Times, and Wired. Her latest novel, which we'll be talking about today, The Women in the Castle, is about personal responsibility and morality. Stephen has just joined us. And this
the
is
late
really,
Stephen Kiernan.
Yeah, he had trouble finding the library, right?
Yes.
Stephen Kiernan has won more than 40 awards during his career. His two books of nonfiction tie directly into the topics he often speaks about: authentic patriotism, how to restore America's ideals without losing our tempers or our minds. Now, mind you, this was written in 2010. His other nonfiction book is Last Rites, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System. He's also the author of three novels, The Curiosity, The Hummingbird, and today's book that we'll be talking about, The Baker's Secret, which is the story of a town in northern France during the German occupation, World War II. So I'd like to dive right into this conversation, but before we do, I want to just a few remarks. We're going to cover a lot of material in a very short period of time. So as you're listening, formulate your questions. We're dying to hear from you. The primary focus will be on the repercussions of war on the home front. That might be a question for you. What is the home front? It pleases me, as much as one can be pleased by fiction, by war fiction, that of the three books we'll be discussing, all three feature women. The dreary and outlandish notion that persists, that women and war don't mix, just might be put to rest by these novels. In Laura's A Catalog of Birds, we meet with the sister of a Vietnam vet, a woman who tries to save her brother, a man who cannot get past his war wounds and war guilt. Her efforts are heroic. In Stephen's The Baker's Secret, we're face to face with starvation during World War II, a hungry village saved by a quick-witted baker. She too is heroic. And in Jessica's The Women in the Castle, we meet three women who survived World War II, and in trying to rebuild their lives, butt up against what we in this country call complicity. Heroes, yes, but flawed humans. Together, these three books cover women's voices in war-based trauma and recovery. Now, to give you a bit of background, or at least a flavor for the books, I've asked the panelists to read a few paragraphs from their books, just so you know where we're coming from. Then I'll ask a few questions, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. So, as I said, please think of those questions. Laura?
Doesn't matter. Nell is the 17-year-old sister of Billy, who has come home from Vietnam, the sole survivor of a helicopter crash. They share a love of the natural world. Billy is a bird artist and is most at home on the lake where they live, Seneca Lake in Geneva, New York, And his wounds are significant, and he's also suffered some of the typical losses that soldiers in Vietnam did because of the chemicals that we used, which have affected his hearing and his sense of taste and his sense of smell, thereby cutting him off even more from the world that might be able to heal him. I'm going to read you a brief passage fairly late in the book. Marion is Billy's mother. Upstairs, Marion walks in on Billy shaving in the bathroom, standing at the sink in those awful army green boxer shorts. She hasn't seen him this undressed in years. Jesus Christ, Billy, you're skinnier than Nell. She sees the wreck of his flesh from jaw to hand, the bright trickle of blood at the corner of his lip. He slams the door in her face. She knocks. Go away, Mom. On the other side of the door, Billy leans against the sink, looking down into the floating bits of hair and shaving cream, the blood dripping from his face. He can hear the pulse inside his head, the unending buzz and ringing in his ears. His heartbeat is out of control. Marion, where are you? He says, leaving. Get in the kitchen, woman. I want food. She scrambles eggs and toast, makes toast, pulls out homemade strawberry jam. Billy sits at the table, makes a show of eating too much, too fast, talking through a mouthful of eggs. She doesn't scold him. Instead, she sits across from him, steals a piece of his toast, slathers it with jam. Billy pushes his plate away. The eggs and toast dissolve into dust in his mouth. He lights a cigarette, tips his chair back on two legs, raises an eyebrow at her, waiting for the lecture. No smoking at the table. Stop ruining my chairs. That does not come. Uses his plate as an ashtray, a further provocation. He sips his coffee, waits. You've developed some nice manners, she says. Silence. What am I going to do with you, she asks. Kick me out on my ass. Well, that's not what families are for. When he does not reply, Marion asks, who's the girl? None of your business. Be careful, Nell looks up to you. Don't you think she knows all about... Don't wave it in our faces, that's all I'm saying. How does she shame him so easily? Reproach turns rancid as his stomach clenches in protest at eggs and coffee and cigarettes. He looks at her, her hair graying, her stomach going soft, the smile lines around her eyes he'd loved so as a child, etched more deeply now. The skin on her capable hands looks fragile as she reaches for her coffee cup. It would be so easy to touch that soft hand. It's what she wants. It's not much. Their old camaraderie full of jokes and hidden, shared, stolen secrets. Their shoulders touching as they dissolved in laughter, usually at someone else's expense. The yielding softness of her tongue, of her skin, the imploring softness of her need to be loved, the sharp sting of her tongue. So easy to fall back into that if his mother's body didn't repulse him now. All bodies, his own body, flesh and decay, the death inside every living thing. Marion sees the disgust pass across his face, so potent it makes her flinch. Give him time, Jack says to her over and over. He'll come back to us. Will he? She wonders. She sees him waver, soften, then harden against her again. Before she can stop herself, she says, you could take a break from being such a selfish little shit. Billy stands up too fast. His chair scrapes back and falls over behind him. He can't hear it hit the floor, but feels the vibration of its impact in his feet and knees. There's a roaring inside his head. He holds one hand inside the other. The words, can't you see, screaming to get out. He sees his scars split open, his bloody hands fusing to his co-pilot's flak jacket. He can't pull him free. His head lolls on his neck. Blood soaks the collar of his jacket, blood, tissue, bits of bone. He smells flesh burning. Another blast blows him clear of the wreck. Flames burst into the sky. Can he get to Frank? Can he? He has kids. Frank has kids. Can't you see? Can't you see? Marion's mouth is open, but he can't hear her. She is shouting his name, Billy. He slams out the back door. He wants to beat his hands against the side of the house, the sharp corners of the porch railing. Billy. He holds his hands in front of him to keep her away. She keeps coming toward him, puts her arms around him, tries to cover the flame of his rage, holds him. It's okay. It's okay. Her touch scalds him. He wishes it would rain. He wishes it would snow. Thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to read the opening of The Baker's Secret. All through those years of war, the bread tasted of humiliation. For as long as their nation had possessed a history, the residents of Verger Village had been a people of pleasure, devoted to the senses without shame, and none savored more unapologetically than those of the kitchen. Over a span of centuries, their culture had turned the routine animal act of feeding themselves into an art form. Delectable breakfast morsels with steaming coffee as dark as mud. Calming lunches in the shade when haste is the enemy and cheese is the dessert. Dinners luxurious, candlelit, and lasting hours. Such was the rhythm of their days. Who has a story to tell, and shall we place some flowers upon the table? It did not matter that they lived in a tiny village, a kilometer from the chilly northern sea, their occupations either of the farm or of the ocean. If anything, the labors of manure and milking, mending nets or hauling them, only intensified their love of flavor, patience, the company of friends. Therefore, the baking of bread, a nearly day-long alternation between active kneading of dough and passive waiting for it to rise, could be as gratifying as deep breathing. In the hearth of the oven, where baguettes basked side by side, making loaves echoed making love. Then came the occupying army to teach their senses other lessons. The clack that boot heels make when snapped together at attention. The dull smell of a rifle after the barrel has been oiled. For some, this instruction included a comparatively milder discovery that even the most pleasing kitchen task, when it is made compulsory, becomes tedious. Consider Emmanuel, lovely, gifted in the kitchen, a fawn of 22 years. In any other time, the modest bakery where she was employed would serve as a center of commerce and community. In another era, she would be distracted, preparing sweets for her Philippe, or taking all day to boil chicken stock down to reduction so potent with concentrated flavor it could cast spells, all while dreaming of the drape of her someday bridal dress. Instead, she rose before dawn that day, the 5th of June, to the crowing of her rooster, a belligerent, strutting shouter, widely known and universally disliked, whose name was Pirate because of the dark patch around one eye. Having slept on the floor beside the couch on which her grandmother now snored, Emma folded her quilt, tucked it away, and tiptoed from the parlor without waking the aged woman or causing the occupying army's captain to stir upstairs. Slipping into her shoes by the threshold, Emma strode with purpose across the barnyard. Pirate charged after her in full lecture, his hens, his morning, his territory, until she found a pinch of feed in her pocket and tossed it by the path, winning his silence long enough for her to reach the baking shed. Emma stirred somnolent coals in the brick oven her father had built, tossing in chestnut shells for kindling, giving the ashes a single long breath until they glowed awake and the shells crackled. Then began the tedium, the task the commandant had ordered her to perform 7 days a week, as though she were some cow with milk to be wrung from her straining udder at morning and eve, or a chicken whelping one new egg per turn of the earth. With each passing day, Emma's love of baking grew a fraction drier, till what had once been her greatest joy dwindled to barely a husk. She lifted cheesecloth from several bowls on the side table and saw the dough risen there like white globes. Satisfied with what she saw, Emma punched the rounds, each one contracting with a clean, yeasty sigh. Only then, and after a glance out the opening to reconfirm that Pirate was the sole creature stirring, she reached behind a hanging cloth into a bin, 5 times returning with a handful of golden powder that she sprinkled onto the dough. Straw. ground fine each day to supplement the batter. Containing no nutrition whatsoever, its sole purpose was to add bulk. Thus, with the rations of flour, she received to make 12 loaves daily for the commandant and his men, enlarged to produce 14, two of which she would secret away to divide among her neighbors and whoever in the village was in direst need. There was never enough. There would never be enough. Each morning required every crumb of Emma's skills, all of her artifice, to bake loaves containing straw and have neither the commandant nor his officers notice. Yet this was one of only 500 deceits, all conceived during the long strain of the occupation. She learned to sow a minefield and reap eggs. She could wander the hedgerows pulling a rickety cart, and the result would be maps. She could turn cheese into gasoline, a light bulb into tobacco, fuel into fish. She could catch, butcher, and divide among the villagers a pig that later every person who had tasted it would insist had never existed. And all of these achievements would occur in a land of violence and slavery and oppression. In a time of humiliation, the only dignified answer is cunning.
So I'll read a tiny section here from farther on in my book, and I chose it because my book is trying to, one thing that I was trying to do here was really explore a lesser known perspective of the war, which was that of ordinary Germans, and to try to answer for myself or try to explore for myself the question of how could they have let this happen? How did they enable and participate in the Holocaust? One day, after nearly a year in Dortmund, Anya passes the local Winterhelfswerk, the Winter Help headquarters, and notices a sign for blankets, coats, warm clothing, and other necessities. She hesitates. She and her boys are no charity case, after all. Until several well-dressed women precede her. Inside, the canteen has been remade into a shop with piles of goods arranged for perusal, carefully sorted by size and type, warm wool coats and sweaters, feather beds, pillows, and leather boots. Volunteers distribute tickets to those waiting. Two coats per family, two pieces of bedding, shoes for everyone. What a windfall. Thank goodness she has arrived early enough for the best picks. She selects a lovely camel-colored wool coat with silver buttons for Anselm, much finer than any he has ever owned. A thick green wool cape for Gudrun, two feather beds, and a practical pair of shoes for each. The question of where all this has come from does not even occur to her until she checks out. Redistributed, the volunteer stamps on a paper listing the items Anya has selected. Redistributed from where, Anya asks. From deportees, the volunteer says curtly. So these are belongings Jews sent east have left behind. The thought is dismaying. Some little boy had to leave this handsome coat. But then it confirms what the Fuhrer has been saying. The Jews of Germany have made themselves unreasonably rich. Who would leave behind such a coat unless they owned an even better one they could bring along? Bring where is the increasingly uncomfortable concept, though it is still outside the realm of Anya's immediate concern. In the beginning of the war, Anya imagined the resettlement camps to be humble, organized places like her lager, focused on re-education and run with German efficiency. Early in her Landjahr training, she received a glowing booklet about a camp for Jews in Poland, a clean, orderly place with a hospital and a vocational training program. The word resettlement conjured an image of a village emptied of its inhabitants who had been resettled to another village emptied of its inhabitants who had also been resettled, and so on, with each population pushing further into the wide and roomy east. A continent of people shifting to make Lebensraum, living space, for their bursting population. There is an easy logic to it. After all, there are 80 million people living on 500,000 square kilometers in Germany. Anya has memorized Hitler's facts. They need more space, more resources. But now everyone knows that the settlements are really just camps, and the camps are no better than the squalid Jew houses where the few remaining Jews in German cities have been confined. Last month, when they cleaned up Dortmund, the citizens were told to cover their mouths with cloth or stay indoors while the soldiers marched the last Jews to the trains. Many years later, in another lifetime, Anya will enter an American secondhand store with her daughter and be overcome with an instinctive horror. "Do you know where all these clothes come from?" she will ask. "People who don't need them anymore," her daughter will say with a shrug. "Why do you ask?"
Thank you, Jessica and Stephen and Laura. That gives you a feel for what the books are about, and I hope you enjoyed it. Now, I'm going to ask a few questions, then I'm going to turn it over to you. Keep thinking about those questions. I know I sound like a teacher, but and some of my former students are here, so they've heard this before. Now, here's my first question, and I came across this recently. In Search of Alias Grace, writing Canadian historical fiction, Margaret Atwood wrote, "Individual memory, history, and the novel are all selective. No one remembers everything. Each historian picks out the facts he or she chooses to find significant, and every novel, whether historical or not, must limit its scope. No one can tell all the stories there are." So you've all written about the repercussions of war. Why did you choose to tell the story that you did? Let's start with Stephen.
You know, she sent us advanced questions to give us an idea of what she was going to ask, and I said I really like these questions as long as I got to go last.
And that's why he's going first.
And this is my punishment for having made that joke in email. Years ago, I worked in newspapers for about 20 years before I started writing books. And one of the last stories I did before I left newspapers, I loved that work. And one of the last stories I did was about a ship that went down in Lake Champlain. And it didn't sink in a storm. It was a beautiful, clear night, and the pilot ran it aground. And it turned out it was because he was piloting while high. And this is a paddle wheel steamer. This is 150 years ago. He's high on morphine. And everyone was evacuated off onto boats that took them back to the nearest harbor, except one guy who had just finished law school who woke up the next morning, and he was alone on this boat that had run aground because he was so intoxicated. And I realized that when I was doing that story I wasn't really writing about a ship running aground. I was writing about human nature. And there are ways that a law student, having finished law school, would probably be intoxicated today, too. And that there'd be people that would be driving long-haul trucks with some kind of stimulant to help them go long miles, things like that. And so that was a discovery for me, the extent to which history reflects on the present and shows us things about human nature. When I was researching this book, there was a story I ran across where... part of the Nazi defenses was the Atlantic Wall, right? It was basically a concrete wall from Norway to Spain. And most of it built with forced labor by Frenchmen. And there was a day that this one commandant of this one area said to the men who were working on the wall, "Tomorrow, the field marshal will be coming to inspect the work on this wall. And when he arrives, to show respect for him, you will remove your hats." And this is at a time when, for a Frenchman, wearing a beret is as common as wearing pants. And the commandant said, "Those who will live to have dinner tomorrow night will be the ones who remove their hats." And the next day when Rommel arrived to do his inspection, lo and behold, all the men had come to work bareheaded that day. And they all got very bad sunburns working outside all day next to the sunny ocean. And the sunburn became a symbol of rebellion. I loved that there were people that they still had their own, with no words, they had maintained their own dignity in that moment. And in fact, in that area in Normandy, a suntan became a popular thing. Freckles were considered appealing, sexually appealing, so on. There was this whole cultural thing that happened, and I realized that, again, that was like a human story. It was human nature about dignity. It wasn't about that moment. And so, to me, there was so much about our current time that was reflected in how people dealt with a really fierce division, a lot of violence, a lot of anti-Semitism, and that the story that I found in my research in Normandy is that sometimes the most rebellious thing that people can do under those circumstances is to be kind to one another. So that was what led me to find this story in history that I felt like reflected on our time.
Thank you. Jessica?
So the question is sort of, how did I come to write this, mm-hmm. and this of all subjects? Well, it's sort of a long answer, but the short answer is that it's a subject that's very near to me because I'm half German, and I grew up hearing my mother's stories of her childhood in Germany after the war. She was born in 1943. And so as a kid, I listened to those stories. I visited the farm that my mother had grown up on, and I loved going there. I loved the cake, I loved the countryside, and I loved most of all my grandmother. But at the same time, I had really been raised with a strong sense of awareness by my mother of what a terrible place Germany had been and the horrors that it had inflicted on innocent people. There was never a time in my life that I remember not knowing about the Holocaust. So I had this kind of dueling sensibility that on the one hand, I had a lot of shame about being half German, and on the other hand, I did love my grandmother, and that was always really at odds for me. And I spent some time when I was in college interviewing my grandmother and hearing more about her story and what she had been doing during the war, what she had been doing after the war. And it was very complicated, and I spent a lot of time thinking about the schism in her life and how people live with themselves. Touches a little bit on your book, I think, Laura, but how people live with themselves with tremendous guilt and responsibility, and how do you go on with that, and what do you do about that? How do you reckon with that? So that was just something that has always been very much personally interesting and in my heart, and I didn't feel quite ready to actually take that subject on and figure out my avenue into it until I started writing this book, which then took me 7 years to write, so this is now a long time ago. But it was kind of, that all sort of amounted to all of these ideas swirling around in my head for a long time kind of got winnowed into these three characters who are totally fictional, but who I did draw on some of my grandmother's stories for, and also a family friend who was involved in the German resistance, whose stories I kind of thought about a lot and researched more.
I have been just so haunted by the fact that 1% of our population is bearing the entire burden of the forever war that we are involved in. And we seem to be unable to talk about that, perhaps because so few of us are serving. And I thought that if I could write about Vietnam, we might see some parallels to a war we don't understand, we haven't dealt with, we don't know why we got into it or how we got out of it, and the same things occurring now in our present in Iraq and other places. I was also incredibly haunted by the fact that we are losing a service member to suicide almost every hour of every day. And then where this intersects with my own life in terms of Vietnam, my dad, just to go back a little further, in World War II, my father was a navigator bombardier. He sat in that plexiglass bubble underneath the nose of the plane and came home. I wasn't born yet, but came home and had what was then called a nervous breakdown, and took him about 10 years to put himself back together. And then my parents had two sons. My two brothers are older than I am, who were exactly the right age for Vietnam. And in the way of the world, this has been going on for centuries. And rather than be drafted in 1966, one brother graduated from high school, the other from college. They both enlisted. And so I'm still a kid at this point. My brothers are quite a bit older than I am, and seeing the depression that my parents are going through as their children are going to war, when they thought that their sacrifices were all about making the world a better place so their children would never have to do this. And as an adult, these things are continuing to be part of me, the trauma that my father experienced, the traumas that my brothers experienced, and my personal understanding of those traumas. We think that wars are discrete events, and I'm here to tell you that they're not. That they are events that go on and on and on for those who participate in them, and we now know also their families, because these traumas tend to become almost like something that's in our blood. And so I'm trying to come to grips with that in my own life and express something about my concern about our current forever war by turning the lens to Vietnam in the hope that we can see that. Can we see that story yet? And talk about it, and talk about our complicity, because we're apparently not seeing what we're doing now, and how do we raise that consciousness?
Good. Thank you. I'm going to ask two more questions, and then I'm on to you. And this one, Stephen made fun of me for sending around. he called Nietzsche a joker.
No, I said he was a jokester.
Jokester, that's right. Okay, so Nietzsche wrote that we have art so that we won't be destroyed by the truth. It's a beautiful sentiment. So I'm wondering to what extent art whitewashes or exposes the truth of war. The big question really is, what truth threatens us, and how does that play out in your novels? So let's see, why don't we start with Jessica this time? You're not going first.
You would think I would be prepared since you've outed this
as you
previewed this question.
You.
I guess I was thinking about it in a sort of macro sense, and thinking about art and truth. Does it expose or whitewash the truth, or what is the truth that is revealed? I mean, I think almost every novel you could make the case that what is revealed is the complexity of life, right? Mm-hmm. That things that seem simple on the surface have so many currents and channels running within them and move around in circles as opposed to in a straight line. And I definitely think that is true in my book, and that was something that my characters kind of are increasingly, especially there's one main character I have who is a very sort of morally authoritative person, and she is, my characters, they're three women who whose political beliefs and experiences really span the gamut of the German experience of that time. And she's on the end of having seen the evil of the Nazis as it unfolded and having recognized it and having taken action. And she is a true resistor. Her husband was executed in the resistance. And she has gone through life with this kind of moral certitude. But as the book goes on and it leaps into, it's in 1945 and then 1950, and then it ends in their present day, which is in the 1990s. And this, her certitude starts to unravel, and she realizes toward the end of her life that many of the things she's often sort of not seen the trees for the forest, so to speak. Many people miss the forest for the trees, but she's sort of on the other end of that. So she was sort of a main character for whom I think that question really applies, like what is the truth that kind of is unveiled within her and to herself?
Identifying small truths that turn out to reveal either a big lie or a bigger truth.
Yeah, just be that things are complicated, and you're generally mm-hmm. things that you see in a really black and white way, when you get close enough, are going to start to break into shades of gray.
Yeah, Carol King, Shades of Gray. Laura.
Remind me of the question.
What truth threatens us, and how does that play out in your novel? And I can think of a lot of answers for you.
Good. You know, my novel does not have a happy ending. And I got a lot of pressure from my agent and several of the editors who considered buying my book that it should have a happy ending. And I love the story of we've suffered trauma, and we pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and go on even better and even stronger than before. We are all inspired by those stories, but that is not the true story of every person in our midst. And it bothers me that we are so wedded to that narrative that there's almost no space or room for another narrative that is more difficult and more complex. And I don't know if it's more truthful, but it is part of the truth and certainly part of the truth of soldiers' experiences.
That sometimes there is no happily ever after. There just can't be, by virtue of the fact that, you know, off you go to war, you come home, you expect things to be a certain way, and they're not. Stephen.
Well, the first thing I want to do is plug both of these books, because I'm thinking about, as you're talking about, I'm thinking about truths that that I encountered as a reader. And there's, I'll just give an example from Jessica's book in terms of these people's awareness of what's going on and the extent to which they let it in. I believe it's this very morally upright, and maybe uprighteous, woman sees a train going by and she thinks there are bags of food in it. Pretty sure it's food. And she's like, oh, look, there are bags of food going by. And then she looks a little closer, and actually those are curled up prisoners. And to me, it was like a roundhouse punch. It was so powerful because her discovery was my discovery as a reader, and it just made me think about what are the things that we don't see. Today, you know, I just walked down to the Finagle Bagel down here, and five people asked me for money on the way down. You know, and you think about, I live in a rural place. I'm surrounded by orchards. Nobody asked me for money all day. And so for me, that was a very striking thing. And I was out of ones by the time I got here because, you know, I know you shouldn't give money to them, but they're hungry. And in Laura's book, there was a different kind of thing, and there are many truths in there, but the thing that I loved is that this character, before he's wounded, was really a prodigy at drawing birds. And one of the things he does from time to time, even when he's a complete mess, is he stops and listens and identifies different sounds and bird calls and this kind of this 3D of the forest that happens that makes it a very 3D book to read. And there's solace for him in that. And for a reader who's in this tough story that doesn't have a happy ending, that's solace for me too. And so there's comfort in that. I don't think there are any truths in my book. I think there's perspectives. I'll give one example, and maybe it's a dumb one. Someone occurs to me. There's a moment when my main character, Emma, is walking by a field, and there are a bunch of German soldiers that are being made to shovel mud into a little drainage ditch, and it's backing up the water, and it's flooding the field. And it's the first week in June. So not only has that field been harrowed and planted and maybe fertilized, but the green stalks are there, like the growing has begun, and this field is being flooded. And she's from a rural community. She's like, these people are the most wasteful army ever. There's going to be nothing to eat this fall. They're ruining this crop, and they're ruining this field. What kind of a people would do this, would have such disregard for this field? And the field is ruined. It's flooded with water. And what I was working from was an actual thing in history, which was that German spies found out that if there was an invasion in that area, it would involve a lot of paratroopers, and that this was a good landing area. And so they flooded the field. And back then, you didn't land and clip out of your gear like you do now when you're parachuting. There were very strong canvas straps on you, and you had a knife, and you cut yourself free of it. And these guys were parachuting with 180 pounds on them. And there was one group of 220 paratroopers who went into this field, and 90 of them survived the water. Oof. It absolutely worked. Yeah. So the perspective I had is historically accurate. The perspective I had was a rural person saying, this army makes no sense, when in fact there was a savage, brutal, effective intelligence that was at work all that time. And so a lot of the novel is about that, is to take a very, very intimate perspective on the war. There's a long session that's just about one egg, one third of a loaf of bread, you know, people who are hungry, and how that reflects kind of this brutal intelligence that is part of our species.
Beautiful, horrifyingly beautiful. I'm going to, one more question. Roy Scranton, who, I don't know if you know Roy's book, War Porn, wrote that every true war story is a story of trauma and recovery. So my question here is, since all the novels that we're talking about today are meditations of a sort on the entanglements between global trauma being war and personal tragedy, so my question is, how did you square really the personal and the political, and I'm talking about your characters really, the personal and the political, contradictory attitudes toward war, what you just wrote being an example, or what you just talked about being an example, and then the idea of trauma and recovery. How did you weave all of that together? How did you square it?
Wow. These are really hard questions.
Take it apart. In your case, in Laura, I really like Laura to talk about trauma and recovery, how that worked in your novel, that what the sister did to try and bring her brother back.
They share this love of the natural world and have been, you know, as one character says, been sitting around in the woods for most of their lives listening to birds. Billy is actually able to imagine himself into birds and is so good at what he does, he can identify individual birds. He would tell you that they can recognize him as well. And he can recognize the parentage of birds as well. He knows that this bird came from this family strain of birds. It's quite remarkable. And his trauma cuts him off from that and cuts him off from probably the one thing that could heal him. I think the thing that I'm left with around trauma and recovery is that recovery is a much longer process than we are comfortable acknowledging. In the same way that when someone dies and we go to a funeral and we check in with them a week later, you know, by now everyone in this room is old enough to know that it's all just begun. But our culture says take a couple days off from work and then you come back and everything's all fine. But it isn't fine, and it's not going to be fine for a long time, which is also true about the trauma of war. And in particular, I think I'm trying, in the book I'm trying to write about the trauma of Vietnam in particular and the current wars that we're in, is that there is no, it isn't a righteous war. We cannot see ourselves as the great ones. We cannot see ourselves as the good ones. And a lot disappears in this war, and part of what disappears in Vietnam and what's disappearing from our culture now is our sense of who we are and our sense of coming together as a community and understanding each other and making decisions about the wars that we're fighting. I wonder where the peace movement is. We've had some hiccups around that, but nothing sustained. I wrote my first book in 2008 about the Iraq War. And at the time, we'd been at war for how many years? Six at that point? And I would say at readings, you know, if you'd told me we were still going to be at war when I started to write this book 2 years ago, I would have said impossible. Wow, this is already longer than World War II. And yet we've doubled that period of time now. And I think we are all traumatized by it. And I don't think we can recover until we understand our complicity in what is happening in our name. And that's one of the things that may be starting to happen around the Vietnam War. I don't know if Ken Burns' documentary is inspiring a lot of conversations about this, but the trauma in my book is a trauma that's ongoing, and there is, one gets better, but I don't think one recovers.
And I think the same could be said of the trauma, World War II trauma. And Stephen and Jessica, maybe you can address that.
Julie?
Well, I definitely thought that a big kernel of what my book was about, or what inspired me, was thinking about the trauma of that, of Germany in general after the war, and how, what a shameful trauma it was. So it was really, people didn't talk about what had happened. There was very little public recognition. Because it was a decimated country, but also a country that was, you know, the moral psyche of the country was decimated as well by what they had been complicit in. So I was fascinated by some of the pieces of information that I learned as I started researching this and thinking about how these played into the everyday lives of my characters. Like, you know, many of you may be familiar with the fact that there were 20 million displaced people and refugees in the summer of 1945 in Germany. So for a country of 80 million to have 20 million displaced people in a state of total ruin where the infrastructure of cities has been destroyed was fascinating to me. And to learn how the UNRRA, which was the United Nations Relief Agency, built these camps and put them together, and how ultimately this was, I mean, I suppose you can look at it in a successful sense, because ultimately the last of these camps closed in 1957.
Wow.
So this was not a short-term situation, but these people, schools were created, people got educated, and all these people are now living around the world, various different kinds of successful lives. My daughter's math teacher, I learned, had grown up. She was of Latvian descent and had grown up in one of these camps. These camps were just like mosh pits of confusing arrays of people, because it was concentration camp survivors, concentration camp guards from the East, who in the beginning were even put into the same camps with the survivors. They didn't want to go back home because they were afraid of retribution for having collaborated with the Nazis. Then there were people whose homes had been bombed, which was a huge percentage of people. So it was like people from the Ukraine, from Albania, from, I mean, it was everywhere, all mixed up in these camps. Another thing that I thought, you know, the trauma that was being sort of silently processed during those years, the fact that many German soldiers didn't were prisoners of war after the war, and the United States released their German prisoners of war by the end of that summer, but France held on to German prisoners of war for several years, clearing mines in the French countryside. Russia returned its last German prisoners of war in 1956. So again, this weird piece of the culture that was profoundly affected on the home, you know, microcosm level of these families. And then the last point that I'll make on that was just another thing that I came across was, I mean, all of these things, I'm sort of thinking, how does this fit into your everyday life, going around and rebuilding things, rebuilding your, getting food on the table in a time where there's very little food. There were these posters that were put up in German towns in the summer of 1945 that were put up by the Allies that were to make the German people understand their guilt and responsibility. And they were pictures, that the kind of pictures that have become really, you know, iconic, and we almost don't see anymore because we've seen them so much, and they come to represent horror as opposed to actually be horror. But at this time, they were fresh, new pictures of the liberation of Dachau and Buchenwald. And the words over them, who did this, you did, or these sins, your guilt. And I thought, wow, these people were walking around through their towns, seeing these posters every day. And how did they manage that? How did that go into their minds? And what did they explain to their children? And they really didn't. They didn't talk about it. But anyway, to me, those are all pieces of that kind of trauma. And how does that express itself?
I've been told we have to take some questions now. So
sorry, Stephen.
Stephen, you can.
Should I skip my answer then?
He wants to skip his answer.
No, I don't. Can I say a 10-second answer to that?
Please.
I believe that we share a trauma, that we all share the trauma of 9/11, and that Hollywood has decided the answer to that trauma is a superhero that will come save us. Mm-hmm. And I think it's horseshit, but it pays them billions of dollars if you add up all these movies. And there is a literature right now that is about the power of the individual. It doesn't always work out well, but there's a whole literature. It's what we're doing, and Anthony Doerr with Light in the Ruins, and Kristen Hanna with The Nightingale, and Chris Bojan and Light in the Ruins, Anthony Doerr, Light We Cannot See. There is a literature about the power and role of the individual as a force of goodness and hope. And I think that's actually really important. I didn't know I was part of it. I was just in my basement working away trying to make this book work. But it turns out you read these books, and I think that there's actually, like, if you talk about art as a medicine for the trauma we experienced, I think you're seeing it. It's not on the screen. It's not the spectacle. That's just more Jurassic Park. It's actually happening in the pages.
Stephen, nice. Thank you so much. Nice.
There you go. I'll get head up.
Questions? I see somebody in. Oh.
Thank you very much. Really interested in all the books and all your thoughtfulness. You talked about denial. I think everybody did in one way or another. And I'm thinking about the continuing denial, and not just of Vietnam, that's part of it, but even in terms of World War II, You know, when the Smithsonian tried to have a sort of truthful exhibit about the Enola Gay, is that what it's called, the plane mm-hmm. that dropped the bomb, there was so much resistance, they had to take it down. There's still, you know, during that war in the United States, there was a lot of denial about what was going on. Vietnam, obviously, still, you know, powder keg and denial and so forth. So I guess I was interested in your thoughts about how that lives on. Your general thoughts or even ways you ran into it when you were writing your books or attempting to research your books?
Anyone?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that something that really interested me is this, afterwards, this idea of, you know, you go through that time, how are there Germans, like my own grandmother, who would say, I didn't know. Right. And you look at everything that was in the literature and everything, you know, that you could hear, and from where we sit now, it seems impossible. How could you not know? And I don't know if I believe that. I don't know in which ways I believe it. I think she believed that she didn't know. And I think there are different ways of knowing. You can know mm-hmm. something very truly and intimately, and you can also know something in an extremely peripheral sense that you don't think about. But I think one thing that makes me think a lot about the narratives this leads me in my own life today to think a lot about what narrative am I being fed? What narrative am I just swallowing because, oh, I agree with MSNBC, so I'm going to listen to that, or, oh, I agree with Fox News, so I'm going to listen to that. And I try really hard to put those narratives up against each other and fact check them myself and question them myself, because I'll tell you something very profound that I remember asking my grandmother when I said, well, what, if you ask anyone who was alive during when JFK was assassinated, you say, where were you? They know. They can tell you right away. I said, well, where were you? If you didn't know, where were you? How did you find out? And she said, oh, I don't know. I thought, well, that's... And then it came out. She said, well, you know, it was... Hitler talked about for the last several months of the war that it was propaganda. That the pictures that you saw of the camps were actually the pictures of German soldiers in Russian camps. So, it was like she had believed that narrative, and so it took an unwinding of that. And, of course, she did come to know and accept, and to the end of her life, it was her, you know, biggest thing to grapple with, to that mistake that she had made. But there was not this aha moment because it had all been infused by the sort of narrative that she had been eating up and then telling herself. So, anyway.
Anyone else?
Another question?
He has a question.
We need that. Can you hang on for the microphone?
I'm okay.
We're recording it.
Yeah, and the movies, too, they were forced to go see the footage.
Mm-hmm. I think Stephen has something to say.
Just the denial is a great plot device. So you remember I said, I read at the beginning that it's the 5th of June, right? The 6th of June was the invasion. So in that later that day, maybe 9 o'clock that morning, Emma, the main character, says, the Allies are never going to come. They're never going to save us. They're never going to be here. This is how it's going to be forever, and that's why we need to be cunning. And she's in denial all the way until here, this part here. That's the morning of the invasion. So all of this time in the book, she's in denial. This is her Guantanamo period. This is her rendition period. This is her camps period, right? She says, they will never come. They will never come. And even like as it's happening in front of her, she still does her daily rounds. Like it's still normal life. And I think part of it is we just have our tasks and stuff, but it's a narrative tool as a plot device to have someone who's in denial. The reader really wants the truth to come out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do I have another question? I think you see there in the fourth row.
Yes. Hi.
I started school the same year that the Second World War started. I mean, in grammar school, we used to buy war savings stamps and things. So I grew up with that war and the big effort that people made for it. And then the Korean War was next. And what was after that? The Vietnam, I guess, followed that. And then the invasion of Iraq followed that. But I got to start with a sense of people working together for a common goal and things. But also, and my reading and movies, and not so much movies, but books like yours, that there is Joachim Fest's, there's a grand scheme we learn about war, but there are hideous little individual sufferings and things that we don't see. And my real question is, I think our young people are missing a whole sense of what going to war is really about, and the effects on the community, on individuals. Movies about war are, you know, shoot 'em ups, if there are any really good movies anymore about it. I don't think television is doing it, but the message that's in your books, I wish could get to young people. I don't know if we teach, you know, social studies or history in school that got us interested in it back then. But I guess it's not so much a question of what could we do possibly to...
That's a good question. The what can we do and what will your books do? And I'm going to just direct this last 3 minutes of this to go my book and help destroy the world as it is. That's a Russell Banks quote. Okay, so help destroy the world as it is. What do we, in these books, what can we do is the question.
You want me to go first?
Go first.
Okay, so like I said, the most radical thing that people can do in this difficult time is be kind to one another. And everyone that I'm seeing around me right now is busy taking sides on absolutely everything that they can think of. And I have a sign in my house that says, let peace begin with me. That before we can solve our problems, we need to be peacemakers and healers. And those are big, broad words. But the point of this novel is that this is a woman who's trying to feed her village. She refuses to carry a weapon. She refuses to, she has an opportunity to kill a bunch of the oppressors, and she doesn't, well, you'll see if you haven't read it. But there are, that she really decides she wants to feed people instead. And I think that's as prescriptive as I can make the novel be.
Good prescription. Jessica, and then Laura.
Oh, well, I'll just repeat what I mean, I think my biggest takeaway is that we really need to check our own narratives and know what narratives you're buying into, know what you're telling yourself, and question.
Good. Yeah. Laura?
And read, and inspire the next generation to read. All of these books would be amazing in American history classes or in world history classes in high school and college. We are reading less and less, and we're reading shorter amounts of books in our curriculums, and I think we could reverse that, and that would be all to the positive.
Beautiful. To that end, I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank our panelists.
Thank you.
Thank you.